Hey friends, this is Anurag, and before we kick off season 3, I just wanted to pop in and thank each and every one of you for showing your love and support during the last couple seasons. I've had a blast creating the episodes, and we have a terrific lineup for you for this one. So I hope you continue to enjoy the podcast, find value in our episodes, and that we continue to put millennials front and center in the discourse that we have today. Season 3. Here we go. What's up, friends? Welcome back to yet another episode of Millennial Musings. And as always, I'm your host, Anurag Ramchandran. Over the past couple months, I've had the pleasure of meeting one of the truly remarkable individuals that I know. His name is Eusebius McKaiser. And he's a published author, broadcaster, political analyst, thinker, debater, and also a Rhodes Scholar. I'm in awe of his accomplishments, and I'm really inspired by him and do look up to him in many ways. But I was shocked to realize that both of us, in fact, faced a similar challenge, and that was imposter syndrome. In many ways, imposter syndrome is this persistent internalized fear of being exposed as a fraud in places that we exist or are celebrated in. And this is a feeling that I've grappled with almost my entire life. So I started talking to more of my friends and found out that, in fact, they too suffered from this feeling. And so it got me curious. How does somebody like Eusebius, who grapples with imposter syndrome on a daily basis, just like I do, how does he go on to accomplish all the things despite this crippling fear? I realize that there is a lot that we can learn from his experience, and he was gracious enough to want to be on the show as well. So without further ado, it's Eusebius McKaiser that will kick off season 3 on Millennial Musings with a discussion on imposter syndrome and how we can navigate it. Thank you for tuning in.
Eusebius, my brother, I am so excited to have you on Millennial Musings. It's such an honor to have you, my friend. What is your earliest recollection of, you know, ever having faced imposter syndrome? And obviously, we'll get to what it is and, you know, how it affects us all later. But what were the initial feelings that you faced when confronting it?
When I was 12, turning 13, I started high school here in South Africa, which is where I'm from and where I live. And I went from a school that was exclusively for children of mixed race to a school that was formerly a white-only school. Because of the racist legacy of South Africa, we had desegregated schooling right. Only from the early 90s. Until then, you had to attend a school based on your skin color. And in 1991, we passed new laws that allowed schools finally, and in fact mandated them, to no longer be racially exclusive. So I started high school going from a very working class to poor neighborhood in a brown community to the suburbs where white people live, to one of the best schools in my hometown of Grahamstown, which is where I was raised.
Right.
And I will never forget, Anurag, the first day I arrived at school. I was in the uniform of this amazing school that was, in terms of its colonial heritage, very similar to a posh English school, you might say.
Mm.
Just like in India, you have many schools that are based on what the Brits were exporting as part
Absolutely.
Of to colonial outposts. So the buildings were amazing. The fields were green and luscious. The institutional memory was all around you. And very importantly, I didn't grow up speaking English. Afrikaans, wow. which is similar to Dutch, is my native tongue, my mother tongue. And so there I am in a blazer, in a whites-only neighborhood, in a school grappling with what it means to allow black kids to come in, and I felt like I did not belong.
Mm.
I remember looking at the words of the school song, and the very first line was, "Our fathers passed through the Drosty Gates." The Drosty Gates is a reference to a part of Grahamstown where the school was first built in the 19th century before it had moved to the premises where I had now been a new member of Graham College High. And I couldn't identify with the lyrics because it is not true that our fathers, as in the fathers of the black sons, could ever have been part of the history of the school. There's no way I could have had older brothers, a dad, grandparents that attended this school. So I literally, psychologically felt ill at ease because there I was in a high school that I did not belong to. I felt like an outsider. And right. even though there were other black kids with me, we were a minority. Not more than about 10% of the school population were not white, even though 90% of the South African population is black. And in that particular school, all of our teachers were white. There wasn't one teacher on stage, as I said, at assembly that looked like me or other black kids. And in that environment, I felt like a fraud. I felt like I did not belong. And there was everything about the architecture of that place, the look and the feel, that was unfamiliar. And that made me feel like I am imposing on white people. And that is the sense in which I felt like an imposter.
Wow. And so here you are at a very impressionable age, having, you know, your life entirely moved out and finding yourself in very unfamiliar territory around people that you don't resonate with, looking up to people that you don't resonate with, and deeply feeling a sense of otherness, right? That you don't belong, you don't fit in. Yes. What goes on in that impressionable mind? What happens at that point where you find yourself almost debilitated by this feeling of otherness? What do you take or what do you do to kind of face that or go ahead with that, for that matter?
Beautiful question. The first thing is, a little boy doesn't have the vocabulary to speak and think through what he is experiencing. So right. there's experience happening, but there isn't sophisticated thinking happening and processing. Because I can now, as an adult, as a writer, look back and speak to the experiences of that little boy. But if I try and go back deep into the recesses of my memory and actually be that little boy for the purposes of this dialogue, I didn't have the tools, even as a clever little boy, to be able to voice to myself or to others what I was experiencing. So what do you do? The first thing you do is you go into survival mode. You just hope that you can survive the school day without being embarrassed, feeling embarrassed, and feeling as if something is going to happen to expose you as being a fraud. That's the right. first thing. Related to that, which is really interesting for first generation middle class kids, regardless of the race element, because our parents never went to such schools, I also couldn't go home and say, "Mommy, mommy, daddy, daddy, auntie, school is weird. Did you also feel like this?" Because none of the adults in my life right. would have had a basis for understanding. Plus, there's the guilt. The language we use as poor people is our family is, quote unquote, sacrificing to give us an opportunity to go to the best, most well-resourced institutions. Yes. And so you think to yourself, even if you don't have the language, I had better put up with the discomfort of being an imposter, because at least I'm getting a chance that my older sibling and my cousins who are older never had, who had to go to schools in the colored township, the mixed race township, that weren't nearly as good as this well-resourced school. So you bottle it up, you keep this emotion and this feelings, and you are smiling, photos are being taken, your aunties and uncles are proud and showing yeah. you off to visitors. Come look at our little nephew. He's just started at Graham College Boys High. But secretly, when you get into that combi in the morning, right. this big taxi that is transporting 12, 15 kids all to the suburbs, you are literally going from poverty and Afrikaans to this foreign environment, but your awareness that you are expected to be grateful means that you keep your imposter syndrome to yourself.
Wow. I mean, I resonate with that to a certain extent, but obviously there is a level of otherness that you experienced that was not just limited to a different environment, right? Like this was surely a different environment, but racially, historically, culturally, and also on top of all that, even with your family's history, where education at this kind of level or this kind of setting was never it never happened, right? And so you were there almost having to fend for yourself in those times. A similar experience that I had, I went to a very small school in the first few years of my life, up until fifth grade, called the Kindergarten Starters in Dubai. And it was a mixed school. It was a small, very, very small school. You had like two or three classes. And after, it only existed until fifth grade. So you had to go to one of the bigger schools to finish your schooling, right? And so our own high school, the school that I ended up going to for my further education, was the oldest private school in the UAE, and came in with so much history and baggage, and it's an all-boys school. So here I go to the school in which, you know, my entire existence was maybe like a tiny speck compared to the existence of the school, because it's massive and you have houses and, you know, competitions and culture. And I was on top of everything in the other school, where I was the best debater, I was the best student, I was the best everything. And then I suddenly find myself in the school in which there are already the other best, and I'm a new kid. I'm a nobody. I don't know how to navigate these systems. And I go home and I tell this to my parents, but their reactions are like, but you get to do this, or you are still in this school, and it's so important that you stay, committed or focused, because this is a great school and that's all that matters. So I resonate on a certain level, but I also realized the immense pressure that must have been on your shoulders at that time to now make the best of it. Because ultimately, you still were a very smart kid. You still wanted to make the best of this great opportunity that happened. So how did that transition happen from when you go at this point of like almost feeling choked because of this kind of expectation and feeling of otherness, to try and making this space your own? Because ultimately, you do have to act upon what's around you.
I don't know whether I ever became completely comfortable in that space. I did things to be able to survive 5 years of high school. But whether I ever felt like a bona fide member of the school community is another matter. There are other ways in which you perpetually felt like an outsider as a black kid. So, for example, right, take the school governing structures. When it comes to the mothers' committees that have to look after the boys on Saturday mornings when they go and play cricket or rugby, helping out as mothers to make sure that there's extra assistance when it comes to the tuck shop and how it's being run, for example.
Right.
Our mothers never were part of those structures. My mom never went to any of the parent-teacher association meetings. Black parents were far more unlikely compared to white parents to be governing members of those structures.
Yeah.
So that's just another example. So there are perpetually elements of the institution that constantly remind you that you're an outsider. We had a massive swimming pool. I never learned how to swim. And one of the reasons is because no one amongst the white teaching staff, and they were brilliant teachers. I can honor each one of my teachers as a podcast conversation on its own. And certain things didn't even occur to them about the poor working class kids they had. If you're a white kid, you were more likely to already know how to swim at the age of 13. If you're a black kid, you might be able to, but you are less likely to be able to.
Right.
But when we had swimming lessons as part of physical education, we were just shipped off during the summer parts of two terms to the swimming pool. And it's kind of funny and not funny at the same time, Anurag. So the teacher would always say, if you're not a confident swimmer, be towards the shallow end. If you're a bit more confident, you can be at the deep end. And as you look from the shallow end of the pool to the deep end, literally the skin color goes deep end white and pale skinned, and to the shallow end it gets all the more darker and darker and darker. And in that image, which is in my head, you have everything about the history of South Africa emblazoned. But I want to tease this out just in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Anyone who's listening to this, whether you are listening to this conversation between us in New York, in London, whether you might be listening in Nairobi, whether you might be listening in Delhi, there are variations on this. I'm talking about my educational experiences as a poor black kid going to a former white-only middle-class neighborhood. But quite frankly, to take a radically different example, and I'll pause after this because it's a bit sideways as an analogy. Given, for example, how men dominate boardrooms the world over, many women who listen to this podcast will know what I'm talking about, because when you walk into a boardroom in corporate spaces that are dominated by us males, you immediately feel imposter syndrome as well. And the experience of a 30-year-old woman in a male-dominated company is not unlike the young Eusebius McKaiser in high school.
Fair. And I think this is a good transition point, because let's talk a little bit about what imposter syndrome actually is, and how does it manifest itself? What does it make individuals do or not do in those kind of circumstances?
So I'm not a psychologist, so I won't give a clinical definition, mm-hmm. but here's a working definition that I think is good enough for our purposes of dealing in a collaborative ways as millennials and those of us slightly older with the reality of what has been termed imposter syndrome. So there are two parts of the word. The imposter part, as my example from high school illustrates, refers to this feeling that you are an outsider who is imposing on people or institutions or structures yourself that does not belong there. Mm-hmm. And so you feel a little bit like a fraud who may be busted for not genuinely belonging in that particular space. And that is the sense in which you are an imposter. You are basically wearing a cloak, and hopefully no one is going to take the cloak off you and spot that you're not actually a legitimate member of that organization or institution or society or neighborhood. The word syndrome is actually really interesting. It's not an add-on casually. It does important work in the term, because what it refers to, and this is something you and I have spoken offline about,
right?
The fact that that sense of being an outsider, not belonging, being a fraud, can be so ever-present that like a medical syndrome, it can linger in you. Mm. So let's take a medical analogy that is, I think, useful. When you have AIDS and HIV had in your body developed into full-blown AIDS, the S in that acronym is a syndrome, and it refers to the fact that the immune system has become so deficient, the I and the D, that there's now a systematic inability of the body on a daily basis to fight anything that attacks it. So the syndrome means that the body is so weak that over time and space, as you move around, it is perpetually unable to fight off any kind of opportunistic illness. Now, when it comes to the imposter syndrome, the syndrome part means that that sense of being a fraud, it is there so ever-present that like a syndrome, it doesn't go away at all. It is constantly hanging over you.
Wow. And I think that's a very powerful way to define it. And I completely agree with you on it. But always my curiosity has lingered on the part that when this exists, when this feeling of I might be discovered any second as being a fraud, that I don't belong in this place and I'm just going to somehow get by, and always looking at, you know, all corners just to make sure that nobody doubts whether you belong over there. It's really a debilitating feeling. And I'm curious, maybe from your experience or maybe from others that you've heard of, what do you think are the main impacts of this imposter syndrome? What does it make you do, and what does it prevent you from doing sometimes?
Yeah, one cannot talk about strategies to flourish in the world until you have a full grasp of what the stakes are if you don't utilize those strategies to live a full life. So right. I'm really glad that you are pausing over this question. What is the effect of imposter syndrome? It quite literally cripples you. It diminishes the quality of your life and your act. The first right. thing it does is you are constantly anxious and looking over your shoulder. Now, you know, if you are looking over your shoulder, even if you're good at multitasking, it's very hard to try and deal with something in front of you, let's say a maths problem that you're busy working on that's quite a fun and interesting. If you're also wondering whether someone's going to come along and say, hey, what are you doing here? Your type. I'm not supposed to be here. You're not of the right caste. What are you doing here? So when 50% of your mental energy is taken up by anxieties about being a fraud, then you can't apply yourself optimally to the other tasks at hand. So the very first effect is that you are not performing as well as you can because you have divided attention, divided energies. That secondly leads to an obvious potential problem, which is that if we are really serious about it, this is not just an experiential issue where it feels and it's a nasty experience to feel like an outsider. Your mental health is at stake.
Right.
Because if you are constantly worried about whether you are a legitimate member of a company where you have to spend the next 5 years of your life, or a school, a university, or even just the neighborhood that you've moved into. You get a nice new salary with your new job, but you've moved into a neighborhood where people who look and sound like you don't normally live. You have to be mindful of the possibility that you can have mental health difficulties. And I can tell you for free that there are many people listening to this podcast who will know and nod their heads in recognition of the fact that secretly they would have wondered whether they have depression. They would have wondered whether they should Google the name of a good therapist because of the impact of this feeling of being a fraud. But because we don't have the tools and we're not equipped to recognize the symptoms of imposter syndrome, we find strategies to survive. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But there's a massive difference between surviving and being in survival mode and flourishing. And the most important negative impact of imposter syndrome is that it stops us from flourishing.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I wanted to get to, because there have been so many instances in my life, Eusebius, where I've seen applications or I've looked at things that I know that I'm qualified for on paper, but the thought that, oh, maybe I'm not, you know, or maybe I'm not meant to belong in this community has even prevented me from applying or taking that next step. And I can tell you another example of it is I've been doing podcasting for a while now, you know, and even prior to Millennial Musings, I hosted another one in which I was actually interviewing really important people in the society. And when I started off, I just didn't even feel like I should have belonged in the same room as an MP that had spent, you know, 30 years in the UN and since has become this massive author and is now a member of parliament. And I was seated there in the room, even up until the point of like, he's welcomed me into his room. I'm seated there setting up my devices and I'm shivering in my head. I'm like, okay, I'm going to speak and he's going to know that I'm just putting on a brave face and I don't know how to podcast. I'm not a podcaster. And all this after having done this thing for a while and having known how to do it, how to navigate it, and still it lingers within me. And that's one of the biggest effects of the imposter syndrome that I've seen in my own life is that I know I could have done so several things that I didn't end up doing, or I could have gone and tried to accomplish those things, but somewhere, something, maybe it's that lingering feeling of being a fraud or being discovered maybe in an application or being turned down or feeling rejected, you know, the feeling of rejection, which just pulled me
back. That's very powerful. And I want to honor you for sharing that. Adjacent and related to imposter syndrome are other phenomena that also rob you of living well. And what you've just described is exactly one of them. And let's name it bluntly, self-doubt.
Yeah.
I often look at two or three lines in a byline when I write an article for a newspaper.
Right.
Where there are two or three sentences about who Eusebius McKaiser is that are factually true statements. And so often, even as we speak, I want to reach out to the editor, including for newspaper here in South Africa, where I've been for many years a regular columnist.
Right.
And I want to ask the editor to completely cut it out, not from a premise of humility, which would be a good reason to do it.
Yeah.
but rather because I feel that the description of myself is false.
Right.
I doubt whether that description rings true. Yeah. So you literally shrink and you refuse to even accept truths about yourself because of the self-doubt that usually goes hand in glove with imposter syndrome.
Mm.
Now, I can tell you for sure, the history of the world is such that if you are part of hegemony groups, like white heterosexual males, you don't have that problem.
Or upper class,
and that is
upper class
sometimes
males in
jokingly
India.
Said, but there's a massive sociology behind this joke, and some people won't like this joke, but the joke is actually an interesting joke that as black people, as brown people, we need to begin to learn to walk through and carry ourselves through the world with the confidence of a mediocre white man.
I appreciate you.
I go through what you go through. I go through that even now. I've got three published books. I've got three degrees, each with distinction. I have won the World Masters Debate Championship, National University Championship. But when I hear people read my CV, I quickly go to the stage, and the first thing I try and do is to undermine myself with a joke or two about what I haven't done. Then I will say things to the audience like, oh, do you know I didn't complete my PhD? Do you know that my first book never got published because it was so crap? Now, that's not an attempt at being humble. It's typically the behavior of people who come from previously marginalized groups that we struggle to take our place in the world, even when we've worked hard and achieved a lot. And so we end up literally undermining our own self-worth in the face of true facts about ourselves, because that itself is a consequence psychologically of what imposter syndrome does to you deep into adulthood.
Yeah, and that's so well put, because one of my biggest, and I want to use this example to be a transition point to discussing your experience, you know, in a similar setting as well, which is whenever I talk about my acceptance and subsequent completion of the Schwarzman Scholars Program, and people ask me, you know, like, okay, so congratulations, you made it, or you know, you completed, you were one of the inaugural Schwarzman Scholars, congratulations. And I usually lean on two crutches, right? One is that, oh, I did some, you know, counterterrorism related work that nobody else had done. And so it was a very specific niche area. And I was really young. So as one of the younger people that's working in a very specific niche area, that's why they selected me. Discounting the fact that I did really well in school, discounting the fact that I led several organizations and, you know, started magazines and publications in my university, and just leaning on this crutch of like, I don't want them to like, you know, kind of flash this light on me. And I bring this experience because I want to talk about your experience as a Rhodes Scholar as well. I mean, Rhodes Scholars, obviously the premier scholarship in the world, where you have incredible leaders, young leaders from around the world selected and brought together in the, within the same community living and studying at Oxford. Akin to what I experienced being a 21-year-old walking into a Schwarzman Scholars community where you had everybody around me whose bios I'd read, and you know, I was like, oh, how do I belong here? I'm wondering if you ever experienced something like that when, you know, on receiving your Rhodes Scholarship and going to Oxford and being there and looking around you and you're seeing a bunch of new faces that you never met before.
So the first evidence of that imposter syndrome echoes what I described to you about the iconography of the high school environment. Your first sense of not belonging is when you are in these colleges with dining room tables and Rhodes House as the headquarters itself, where the physical architecture just tells you that you don't belong there.
Right.
Because the cultural grammar that comes easily to those for whom the history of the place, the look of the place is part of their societal history, doesn't come naturally to you as a kid from a different part of the world where you can't, you simply, you can't identify with that. So one of the first things that happened to you when you go up, as they say, is that you have the coming up dinner, which is during the first week or so, where all the new scholars meet the different members of the governing structures, etc. And the first thing that you have to deal with, and this is not unique to Oxford, this is a class issue for many of us the world over, is you have all this cutlery. So you don't want to be busted for not knowing what to use when, you know?
The salad fork. Oh, I still don't know which one is what.
You have to remember little rules like outside, in, all sorts of things. And you might not be the first one to start on your soup because you first want to side-eye someone over there who looks 150 years old to make sure that you actually know what they are doing. Now, you can't immediately fall in love with your academic program when, as you walk at midnight from that dinner to your college, what you are dealing with, whether consciously or unconsciously, is the fact that you're an outsider that have just had a very weird cultural experience. And so immediately your everyday experiences are overlaid between the core reason you are there, leadership and academic advancement,
right,
and the fact that you are in this environment that is quite literally a place where you don't belong. So when I see Rhodes Scholars, particularly ones that have even more class anxiety and dissonance than I had, who flourish. There was recently a young South African Rhodes Scholar who just finished his D4. I'm particularly proud of them because I know, even as someone who already know the grammar of whiteness from my privileged high school education, how difficult it can be to overcome some of that stuff. And if you overthink your experiences, as we do as minorities in particular, then it's particularly hard to do so. So that outsider feeling, as I said to you offline, it follows you around like a stink. So that even when I left Oxford, my first job at McKinsey, I had a similar kind of experience. And you would think that it gets easier and easier over time. But even as an adult, you can grapple with imposter syndrome.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of my biggest concerns as well, Eusebius, is that, yes, here we are talking about it. Yes, we are trying to address this topic. And I've had this conversation with several Schwarzman scholars and several of your fellow, you know, Rhodes scholars as well. And I'm having this with you. And we've had this conversation before. But it's still a daily occurrence. And to my mind, when I think about you especially, right? Here we are, you're an author of three books, you've been a broadcaster, you're a thinker, a philosopher, a political analyst, you've been a McKinsey consultant. On paper, you've accomplished it all, you've done it all. You have a very strong following on social media as well. So you've accomplished so many different things. But here we are still talking about imposter syndrome. The fact that even the most accomplished individuals do face, can face, and will face imposter syndrome at every step of the way is just testament to the fact that this is a prevalent issue and one that we need to discuss. What are some of the steps that we can take to manage it or even hide under that cloak for a little bit while we keep pushing ahead and establishing ourselves?
That's true. Absolutely true. And so it doesn't go away. There's no silver bullet. You deal with it perpetually. And I think it's probably, and we'll get to this presently, futile to ask whether there's the equivalent of a pill you can swallow and you will never again feel like an outsider. It is going to happen. And the aim of the strategies and tactics is to make sure it's not debilitating rather than to avoid it. Because even as you list the things that I've done, you know, after Oxford, again, there's that really inappropriate level of self-deprecation that I would always add. Like I will say, yeah, I've got three books, but none of them sold more than 50,000, even though they were decent sales. Yes, I was at McKinsey, but I was there for 1 year. Okay, I was a broadcaster. Probably that's the one role I'm the most proud of, right. I guess. But... and so you can see what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm pushing back against unqualified listing or praise of each one of the social roles that I have performed. And man, yeah, I wish I had the confidence of heterosexual white male who don't do that, who feel that the world owes them something. And we make apologies for the world affirming us. And those are the two extremes. And I think a healthier way of being is probably somewhere in between, where you have some degree of humility, but at the same time, you don't talk yourself down at every turn because of the consequences of imposter syndrome.
Yeah, and it's a worrying situation that you have the same people, the same group being exposed to those opportunities over and over and over again, and being comfortable in those settings where, you know, an award or an opportunity or whatever it is seems natural to those groups, whereas others are constantly set in this cycle of trying to reaffirm that you belong there and you never really break out of it. But I do wonder, let's say our generation or our families or our lineage, if it may, are able to break out and kind of establish a certain degree of comfort, in your case at an Oxford, or in my case, being, you know, doing whatever I do. Do you think it becomes easier for the next generation to take stock of that and then, you know, have less self-doubt or have less of an imposter syndrome in those kind of settings?
I think there's one part of the diagnostic, as it were, that we've left out that will make it easier for us to tackle the question you've just asked. So I guess one question that's interesting about imposter syndrome is to reflect a little bit, if we can, just parenthetically, whether it's all in the mind, whether the person who is affected by this feeling of being a fraud has invented a condition for themselves that stops them from living and living well, or who is to blame for it. And that's an important issue to pause over before we talk about how to live well.
Right.
I think it's important to recognize that you don't just wake up ready to undermine yourself. It's because there's a history of the world, a social history of the world, in which there have been winners and losers, and then long history is affecting us in the contemporary world. So if you are a woman and you live in a world that is the actual world, which is deeply misogynistic with toxic masculinity in the boardroom, you did not choose to doubt yourself and your ability to lead a big project at Bain or at McKinsey or at some other firm. You come up against men who are constantly jeering you, doubting you, don't want you to lead, want you to be maybe the head of talent, but you can't be the head of strategy because they think that that's what women are particularly good at. So it's really important that we talk about the structural externalities that make it hard for us to wake up and assert our place at the table. And so if you're listening to this podcast, be kind to yourself and recognize that although there are things you can do to live better and to overcome imposter syndrome that we'll talk about in a minute, that you are not solely responsible for not living as well as you can. That it's usually hegemonic forces in society that don't want to let other people in into certain spaces and institutions that make you believe that you don't belong and constantly make you feel that you're not worthy, that you're not qualified, that you're not competent, that you're not fun enough. You know, in the industry you're in currently, Anurag, that I was in briefly, that even the recruitment strategy, they will use language like the airport test.
Yeah.
Can I be stranded with this guy? And all the airport test is he like me, so that if there is a blizzard, I want to spend time with him for 5 hours and hang out with him. But what are you truly asking? You're truly asking, is this person of a skin color, a cultural type, a class type that is not mine, and therefore I want to keep them out?
Right.
That is what you come up against. So there's an enormous battle here to fight for the generation, the millennials, and the next generation. And we mustn't under-describe the enormity of that battle, because these social structures are the structures within which the experience of imposter syndrome happen. Now, can we deal with it? We can deal with it. And if we look at movements like Black Lives Matter, Me Too, there are many interesting global forces currently, digital activism that makes it easier for people that are discriminated against to connect and to push back.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful that we are living through an important historical moment where there's the opportunity to begin to challenge hegemony. But we have to connect the battle against imposter syndrome with the battle against hegemonic forces.
Wow. I think that's very well put. And I think the only the right kind of follow-up question to that is, so what do we do? What do millennials who have the right technological vernacular to utilize and make the best use of the resources that they have at hand, that maybe even better placed than you and I when it comes to technology, or are better versed with, you know, making their needs clear and out there into the community, into the world, what do they do in order to kind of push down the effects of imposter syndrome for as long as it takes to be able to move ahead with our lives? What do we do?
Let's keep it practical and also fun.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing is, let's emulate some of the strategies of hegemony. Hegemony, by the way, if you haven't looked it up by now in this conversation, just refers to dominance.
Right.
So groups that dominate, people that dominate. Men tend to dominate. People with lots of money dominate.
Mm-hmm.
White supremacists dominate in history. So that's loosely what it means. You can Google a more complete definition. So when I talk about hegemony, I'm talking about dominant forces in the world.
Yeah.
We need to emulate some of what they do. A lot of what hegemonic forces do is morally bad. But some of what they do explains why they constantly reinvent themselves as dominant groups. For example, they look out for each other.
Right.
They look out for each other. Men are very good at recommending other men. Men are very good with checking and say, hey, bud, I saw on Facebook last night that she kicked you out of the house. She snooped on your phone and now the whole world knows. Are you okay? I've got a couch for you. Hegemonic forces look after each other. So I think step number one, let's actually not suffer in silence and look after each other. Form a WhatsApp group. Check on your friend.
Support groups, communities. Yeah.
If I can go back to my 13-year-old self, obviously I wasn't mature enough to do this, right?
Yeah.
One of the things I would say to my 13-year-old self now is speak to Gareth, who is another brown boy that is one of your best friends, and see whether he feels the same way as you.
Mm.
Like, imagine the power of just sharing stories.
Yeah.
Like at Oxford, I had that. Some of my black friends and I, who were very close, spent many a night simply talking and sharing stories.
Yeah.
So the image that I like is that of scaffolding, like a scaffold on a construction site. If you feel that you suffer from imposter syndrome, you are not alone. There are groups that typically suffer from imposter syndrome. And we, in the first instance, need to learn to scaffold each other, to hold each other in terms of our pain, our experiences, our self-doubt. That alone will make a massive difference. Imagine every time you feel that you're not ready to make partner at Delberg,
right,
there's no one you can talk to, but you know you can call Eusebius and say, oh shit, they want to make me partner. They think I'm amazing, but I know I'm going to actually F up.
Yeah.
You need to have someone where you can download your self-doubt.
Right.
And that really is important. So we've got to be much better, like the hegemonic groups, at scaffolding each other. The second thing we need to do at a higher level, and maybe on another occasion we can talk about the low-order tactics that go with this strategic intent, Anurag.
Mm-hmm.
But the second thing we need to do strategically is to dismantle hegemony.
Right.
So you have to say to yourself, why should male-centric standards of being a good communicator be the standard that HR uses when they decide whether someone is ready to make partner in this firm?
Right.
I've sometimes been called in as a communications coach, to coach women to be better at communication, only to find out there's nothing wrong with their communication style or technique.
Right,
that the
right.
real problem is that the institution. Yes, the institution says unless you are as assertive like Eusebius, then you're not a true leader. The problem isn't with the person who has a different style of speaking. It is with this unobjective, male-centric definition of leadership that has for 100 years dominated this firm. So again, we've got to push back against very false definitions of excellence and what is normal and what is natural. And that is another way in which we can begin to completely, completely chip away at artificial definitions of what is excellence, what is normal, and what is natural in different spaces.
Right. Wow. And those are wonderful suggestions. And one thing, if I may add to all of this, is that while in many ways social media has opened our eyes to a lot of opportunities and a lot of chances to connect with different people, one of the biggest challenges that I see that we face is the fact that many of us choose to only post our successes and our biggest achievements. Guilty at that. And I'm going to raise my hand first to say that I had this very interesting experience in during my university years, you know, when things were going well with the work that I was doing in counterterrorism. And even right after, during Schwarzman, and even right after Schwarzman, I was very active on social media, constantly posting about the positive progress. Any meetings accomplished, taking pictures with the people that I was with, posting about all my successes, right? And in many ways, it seemed like I could put no foot wrong for somebody that was looking at it from the other end. And I had this friend email me just out of the blue one day after having seen my signature of my email in a newsletter that I'd sent out. And he's like, dude, I'm so proud of you. I'm so great. It's so great to see all these incredible accomplishments. And it seems like you can't put any foot wrong. That hit me at that point because there were so many troughs in between all those peaks. And I was going through depression during that time. I had serious issues of self-doubt. But all I chose to show and project was, you know, these successes. And I guess it has to come with a certain understanding that sometimes it is therapeutic to post about your successes and have it reaffirmed and have people, you know, congratulate you and, you know, tap you on the shoulder and say, well done. But at the same time, we need to realize that it's only one side of somebody's existence usually, and their social media personas is what it is, you know. And so 100%. There is a little bit of vulnerability that sometimes is hard to put on social media. So maybe we have to assume for there being a little bit of, you know, challenges to the storyline or the narrative that's put out there by whoever it is. But at the same time, I also encourage people to be a little more vulnerable with their social media accounts and social media profiles as much as possible, because as much as it is inspiring to see the successes, it is just as inspiring to talk about the challenges sometimes. And the more I've opened myself to having these kind of conversations with you and my other friends, the more I've seen us becoming stronger as a community, even on social media. So that's another point that I would add to it. Yes.
I affirm that point, and I would appeal to anyone who is a mentor or a coach, formally or informally, to role model vulnerability and struggle and even quitting. Mm-hmm. If you no longer derive deep joy and meaning from a particular activity or project, this obsession with completion is something we need to stop.
Right.
Because life is a marathon and it's a long journey. Not every single thing that you do needs to be part of a tick box exercise. Relationships matter, friendship matter. You want to leave the world, hopefully a better place than you found it in. You want to connect in really powerful ways. Those are sort of the overall things for me that makes a life really awesome. But in the details of such a life, we must give ourselves permission to falter, to have self-doubt,
right,
to quit certain things when we want to. But when it comes to mentoring, we have a chance, and you and I have worked together recently as mentors on a scholarship program. It's really important to role model authentic ways of being. And I know the word authentic itself has been bastardized because of all sorts of, it's almost been commercialized to death. But what I mean by it is sincerely talking to the full spectrum of emotions and experiences that you have gone through. And I think one of the ways in which we put pressure on all people, not just the ones, young people especially, not just the ones who have imposter syndrome, but if you have imposter syndrome, you're particularly less likely to be resilient than someone who comes from one of the hegemonic families, is that if you think that your fave never experienced quote-unquote failure, it makes it even harder for you to struggle with your daily struggles. And if you are a mentor, an older person who have millennials in your life, and maybe you're listening to this podcast with a millennial or alone, you really would do both yourself and young people a favor by making sure that your mentoring includes role modeling, vulnerability, self-doubt, and quitting.
Right, absolutely. And I think on that note, we should, you know, start taking the steps towards winding down the conversation, because I don't know how to tie it up in a better way. But I'm going to ask you this. So you see this, if you had three phrases for millennials and nowadays even Gen Z, you know, why not? Because the older Gen Z, we have to keep up with them, you know, and I can't call my podcast just millennials anymore because there are quite a few Gen Zs listening as well. So if you had three phrases of advice, doesn't have to be complete sentences, could be phrases as well, or sentences too if you choose to, of advice for millennials and Gen Z, what would they be? And I'm putting you on the spot here, I know, so take your time, sir.
I knew you'd put me on the spot, I didn't know how. Maybe the first bit of advice would be question everything without being cynical. And I don't know if I need to cash that out, but what I mean in part by that is you're going to be, particularly depending on your society and family and where in the world you are geographically, you're going to be told a lot of things are wisdom and rules that you mustn't break. It's very important, I think, to allow yourself to criticize things that don't make sense to you. Just don't be cynical. So be skeptical, but don't be cynical. So that's the first thing. Question without being cynical. The second would be, it's a not original one, particularly this year. Many people have said this, but I really like this, as overused as the words are, Anurag. Mm-hmm. It's okay to not be okay. Suicidality, mental health challenges are rife in the world, especially this year with COVID-19. And precisely based on what you so powerfully said a couple of moments ago, because we have this obsession with always looking happy, content, successful,
right,
we don't give ourselves and others psychic permission to not be okay. Mm-hmm. If you are feeling sad right now, it's okay to be sad. If you don't want to see your friends right now, don't see them. If you are feeling like crying, allow yourself to cry. Yeah. It's okay to not be okay. So that would be a second one. And maybe a third bit of advice would be, embrace authenticity. So don't perform a cropped version of yourself on Instagram. I mean, we all do that, right? You all want to look nice.
Yeah.
And you want to look blemish-free in your photos and that kind of thing. Curate what you had for dinner and all that kind of stuff. It's okay. So be playful. I'm not saying be unfun and don't be shallow. There's a place for being shallow, for being playful. But fundamentally, make sure that you are at the heart of your online and offline existence, that you are sincere, or if you want the richer concept, that you are authentic. Because if you're not authentic, you are constantly going to worry about, oh my God, did I put on my right face before I go out to the corner shop to go and buy milk? It's far easier to live in this difficult world of ours if you don't have to remember to be someone who you are not.